Welcome. Should be on. Says it's on. Okay. So yeah, we shouldn't have cut it off so quick. You guys are having a great time, and now I'm gonna. But I'm just gonna share a little bit of the work I do with you today, and some of you guys may have seen my students trudging with equipment across campus, running bizarre experiments with carts and strings and things like that. And so you'll see a little bit of what we're doing here. And the overall picture I'm going to start from is really only half the story. So I'm going to talk about the eye a little bit and the brain a little bit just to get you guys organized. That, you know, when you look and you see, there's actually a lot going on. It involves more than simply raising your eyelids. So you're familiar with the idea that you have a pupil. That's the thing that's dark, and there's a cornea out front that helps to focus the light, and there's a lens that does the fine focusing, and then there's a surface back here which is capable of forming an image, essentially. It's all photoreceptive. And then there's a little tiny spot right here called the fovea, which is where your highest density of visual resolution is packed in there. And that's what I use if I want to see somebody or read something, is I aim my eye at that place. And this is actually a really interesting adaptation, because the fovea is it's not found in all animals. And for humans, we have not only foveation, but also a lot of very mobile eyes, like birds move their head around, not their eyes around, because of prehension. We use our eyes to guide our hands. So there's a lot about the visual system I'm going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about the hand system today, but there's a lot about vision that actually has to do with controlling action. And the very structure of the eye, the way it's built, is designed to pull in information to make certain parts of space very available to you in order to control fine actions. Then things go back into the brain. Well, how does this all happen in the brain? Well, this is the front of your brain, and so naturally this cable from the eye comes through back here and connects up at the back. So this is where your first visual area is back here. It's a little bump the back of your head that you can feel. And then the information goes off in all different directions. So it's going to go off and do some face processing, object recognition, space representation for motor control. So you have all these different functions that this system has to do. I'm only going to talk about a little of that. But I thought I'd start you off with a couple fun illusions to wake you up a little bit. So let's see. Get this to work. Where's my mouse? I have to find the mouse. Anybody see the mouse? There it is. Okay. This first one requires fixating. So what I want you to do is fix your gaze right there and keep it there. And I'll try to blow this up. Can I blow this up full screen somewhere? I don't know. Can people see this okay? I think it's all right. The blue stuff is supposed to be a little dark, and the point here is if you look at that middle thing, the three green dots around the outside should sometimes seem to disappear. So if you are successful at keeping your gaze fixed, sometimes all of them will be gone, sometimes some of them will be gone. Those three dots are permanently stable on the screen there, but your visual system isn't sure whether they're part of the world or not, because there's a lot of motion going on, and they're not moving, and sometimes that's something in your eye. So that's just one of the, so when you see stuff, yeah, you getting it? Disturbing? No? Okay. Well, cars don't stay still. This is based on this unusual thing where you're fixating your gaze at one place and you're trying to attend elsewhere. And I wanted you to practice doing that behavior, because I'm going to come back to using that behavior now. Let me stop this thing. Close that right down. And back over here. Okay. All right, here's another point about the eye. I talked about that it has an image surface at the back that sort of forms an image. And that image surface is just a two-dimensional plane. It's sort of wrapped around a sphere. But what you see isn't the surface of that. You're not looking at that, right? You're looking at the world. So, for example, this is a very famous illusion. Roger Shepard made this, won a presidential award for his work in science perception. These two quadrilaterals that are the table surfaces are the same shape and size on the screen here. And if you believe that, I'm very impressed with you. They really are. But of course, what your visual system isn't trying to do, it's not trying to say, what size are those things projected onto my retina? It's trying to ask, what are those things in the world? And this, of course, corresponds to a table that you're seeing foreshortened in this direction. And this corresponds to a table that you'd see foreshortened in this direction. So this must be a long table, and this must be a wider table. And so what you're seeing, what you have is the contents of your experience is a highly processed, interpreted world, not sort of what's just there. And so what I'm going to talk about, I have one more thing to show you. I got to tell you the little personal bit. I didn't want to study perception when I first started out. I didn't think it was that interesting, because you just open your eyes and you see. How hard could that be? I want to study cognition. Like, how does that stuff work? But when I was in grad school, I accidentally discovered something that kind of blew my mind. It wasn't an accident we discovered it. It took us a couple years to fully discover it. But the net discovery was this. I'm gonna walk you through this. This was about 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago now. We can talk about these as two visual textures. And this is going to be your fixation mark for this demo. You don't have to do anything with it yet. But I just want you to observe that this texture and this texture are the same, essentially. They're slightly different in where the dots are, but they're the same in their density. And all I'm going to do now is I'm going to adapt you to textures. I'm going to have you stare at that fixation mark, and I'm going to just show you a sequence of textures. This is going to take about 20, 25 seconds, so be patient. So you're going to look right at that fixation mark and just keep looking at it. Just keep looking at it. Just keep looking at it. Just keep looking. Okay, in a minute I'm going to show you something different. And the next one I'm going to show you is two textures that are identical. If you're staring at the fixation mark, they shouldn't look identical at all. The top one should look a lot denser. It fades pretty quickly. I can do you a quick top-up. I'll just show you the last adapting one again. Just stare in the center there. And then here's the final pair. This is exactly the same texture. That is, these three dots are here. It's the same texture wrapped around. It's exactly the same texture, but it doesn't look the same because your system is adapted. And this is an important issue that I'm going to come back to maybe at the end if there's time. But adaptation is fundamental. So the visual system has to sort of figure out what's out there, but it's using sort of this neural hardware that has to adjust. And because you're moving around all the time, it should expect statistically that basically it's going to get the same kind of stuff everywhere. But if it finds there's an imbalance, it adjusts itself and fixes itself up. And this is really important. Otherwise, our messy brains could never give us the stable perceptual experience we have. So that's adaptation. And as I said, that's going to be a player when we get to the end of this story. Okay, now we're getting to the real story I'm going to tell you about space perception. It turns out that when people evaluate the spaces around them, and in particular I'm going to be focused on outdoor spaces, they make a lot of systematic errors about how that space is laid out. And one of the most salient that's been observed is that hills look really steep. So if you ask students how steep the hill is that comes up from Sharples up to Parrish, the estimate they give, well, I don't know, what do you guys think? So most people say 25, 30 degrees. We've measured it. It's 5.5 degrees, steepest point. Yep, 5.5. Again, not believable, not plausible. You've seen it. You've walked it. It's not plausible that it's 5.5 degrees. It just happens to be the fact that it's 5.5 degrees. Okay? Steepest hill in San Francisco. Well, not the steepest necessarily, but there's a very famous road that's actually, I'm blocking the name of it right now. Lombard Street, thank you. Lombard Street, actually, they built the road to wind back and forth across the hill. The hill is so steep. So how steep do you think that hill is? Well, it's pretty steep. It's 15 degrees. All right? So it looks like a wall. In fact, when I had a journal editor who said, I looked this up on the internet, and it's not. It's 31 degrees. You're wrong. And I said, no. The internet's wrong. It happens. But it turns out the tangent of 15 degrees is 0.31. And so if you express it in grade, it's a 31% grade, where 100% grade means 45. So what happens on the internet is people say 31. Oh, that must be degrees. And that's what he'd seen. But it's 15 degrees. So that's the kind of error we're talking about. It's a very big, dramatic error. Now, there are effects, a part of this, on viewing distance. So when people stand closer to a hill versus further away, I mean, they overestimate when they're close, but they overestimate even more when they're further away. And I wanted to try to give you a set of sense of how we measure this kind of stuff, because we're kind of proud of some of these measurement techniques. I hope it won't be too boring. But so we have a virtual reality system where people wear a headset and they're immersed in a world. They can look around in it, and it's in stereo. And we can simulate surfaces that are that to them are just like real surfaces out there. And what we can do is we can manipulate the slant of the hill and the viewing distance, which is harder when you're like on campus. It's really hard to get a bunch of hills that you can look at from all different viewing distances and have them all matched. So this is the control we have. But we have two different tasks that we can have people do. One of them is to just make a judgment. We have them look at this ball that's sitting on the surface and just say, okay, what's the slant of the hill at that surface at that point? So give it to us in degrees. And you might worry that, well, when people say things in degrees, maybe they don't know how to use degrees or whatever. So we have another task that we do where we have three balls on the surface of that hill, and we say, just tell us whether the distance between this ball and this ball is longer or shorter than the distance between those two balls. So this isn't very good here because you don't have it in stereo, but with a good stereo view, of course, these two balls along the hill are going to be closer on your retina than they are in reality, but you'll form an impression of what that is, and the geometry of what that point is where they seem to be the right distance apart to match this, we can use to deduce the angle you're seeing, right? So the geometry of that is that if the more it's tilted, the closer they can be together and still seem to be the right distance apart. And there's systematic errors that people make in both of these, but they allow us to map out this perceptual relationship between actual slant, viewing distance, and perceived slant. And so when we do that, what we find is that, and I'm showing these as sort of, these are just the lines sort of at each viewing distance, at like a near viewing distance, at a farther viewing distance. What happens is at each viewing distance, the slant gets pulled up a little bit more. But at each viewing distance, there's also this relationship between represented slant and perceived slant, which is that this slope is like 1.5. So that is, this will be accuracy here. But what they're giving us is estimates that increase rapidly. And so they get some idea that what people are doing is they're over-representing the environment. They're sort of saying, well, the environment's, it's pretty flat. They're not thinking that. They're thinking, oh, the environment's really steep. But somewhere back in evolution, somebody said, this environment's pretty flat. Gravity's really strong. We should do something with this. And so what you're doing is expanding this outward in some sense. And the perceptual space that you're working in then is sort of more exaggerated. And I'll come back to that in more detail in a minute. But you can kind of get the idea that this could actually be useful if the brain can make distinctions more easily, can see things different. Then it can use those differences. If it can't see the differences, it can't use them. And I have a slide just to show you that even if we blindfold people and put them on hills, which we like to do, hills seem really steep underfoot. We have people stand on a ramp, and our steepest one was 14 degrees. And people's estimates of it were actually pretty similar to what it would look like to them. They haven't gained this from visual experience, though, because congenitally blind people have exactly the same experience. So it's just a part of our representation of space. Now, based on what we've done, we wondered about downhill slant. You might wonder, well, if you're looking down a hill, should it come up? What should happen? And of course, you guys probably know that when you look down a hill, it looks steep too. But what we discovered was that as you stand back from the hill, if you stand back so that your gaze is looking along, this is with Zhu Li, my postdoc, who's not able to be here today because he's home with his wife. They just had a baby. If you look down right along the slope almost, that's when your perceptual experience is the most exaggerated. You feel like you're looking way down, and the whole thing seems really steep. Whereas if you're standing right at the edge of the slope and looking down on it, it doesn't seem so bad. And we use VR to measure this. But this got us to wonder about, well, slant is misperceived. But if you're, you know, are people really misperceiving which way they're looking? Could that really, could it really be? It just didn't seem likely. Like, I'm looking at you. I know. How could I be wrong about that? And yet, what angle am I looking at you with? You know, what? How much is my gaze declined from straight ahead? And so we set up a bunch of different experiments that I won't bore you with all the details, but the idea was to sort of see if we could get a sense of what do people really misperceive where they're looking. And they do. And in six experiments, we got this 1.5 gain where we could, I'm not going to go through all these things. It's not appropriate for this forum. But the idea is that we could measure this 16 ways to Sunday and still find this different, the same outcome with all these different methods. So that what you end up thinking is it's sort of like Salvador Dali's self-portrait. It's as if we've magnified everything. And so when we look up, we think we're looking up further than we are. That's exactly what a magnifying glass would do. Right? If you're looking at a piece of text through a magnifying glass, you're making everything angularly bigger. And that's what seems to happen in our experience. Now, what's cool about this, if you're a nerd like me, is that there's a long history in which we've learned that people misperceive distance. And one of the neatest, simplest cues to distance is angle of declination of gaze. So if I know how tall I am roughly, I don't have to know this consciously, I just have to have somewhere in my brain it's represented, I can know that the angle of my gaze on a flat surface tells me how far away things are. It's a very nice, elegant measure because it doesn't depend on a lot of computation. I only have to measure one variable, it's already inside my head, not a lot to it. But if I misperceive that variable, as this guy does, then I'm going to think I'm looking at a closer spot on the ground, and so then I'll underestimate the distance. And so other theories of underestimation of distance are that people are bad at estimating distance. That's the general theory. So there's a lot of data about this, and we can take our model just to say, well, if people were thinking they were looking this way when they're actually looking that way, what would they do? Well, here's some data from a couple different labs, and here's what our model predicts. It's pretty good. So instead of saying, oh, people are bad at judging distance, we can say, no, people have an angular bias. They've expanded the universe in some sense in this weird way that changes how distances seem to them. You can do this task. I mean, these are verbal judgments. So you might say, well, it's still kind of verbally, but So a lot of scientists don't like verbal judgments. It's very subjective. But you can have people do a different kind of task where what they're trying to do is we have them out, we've done this out in the fields before there was all the construction. But you have some big pole, like a lamp, one of the baseball lights for the baseball fields. You have a big pole and have somebody position themselves so that they feel like their distance to the pole is the same as the height of the pole. All right? And you can see that this is, in angular terms, this is all about sort of trying to make this distance and this distance the same. And there's a geometric prediction about where people should position themselves. That is, this guy's positioned himself much too far away because subjectively that's his experience. He's at the right spot. And so we can make predictions about, again, where exactly people should stand if they're misperceiving, if they have this gain, this magnification by 1.5. And this is some data from our lab fit against the model. This would be if they were doing it right without any error. And this is from data from Higashiyama's lab from 1988. Turns out the experiment had been done. He didn't have a model of what was going on, but he'd done the experiment, and our data, he'd gone all the way out to really tall things. So his data fit our model really perfectly. So it's really, really the way that is, that as people really misperceive this stuff, it really does seem to be the way that they structure their space. And what about, what does this mean? Well, there's a couple things. If you're a golfer or skier or hiker, if you do anything that involves having to know distances or slants, you actually tend to learn about some of this stuff. So some of you who are skiers probably knew about the overestimation of slant because you've been on ski slopes and you've known about it. And if you're a golfer and I put you in an experiment to judge distance, or especially if you're a caddy, in the putting, I don't play golf myself, but they're perfect. They know exactly how far away things are. And it turns out that there's another group of folks who are really good at estimating distances on grass. Athletes. Why would that be? Well, how far is it to first base? 90 feet. If you don't know that, you're not an athlete. That's apparently among Swarthmore athletes. Everybody knew the distance to first base. I think we only had one baseball player in the whole set, but that's just sort of, you know, how high is the basket above the court? 10 feet. Thank you. Yeah. So the athletes were shocked that there were people on campus who didn't know these things. Like, what? There's just facts about the world. There's just facts about the world. How long is a soccer kick? Penalty kick? So there's lots of these, and they know them. And so if you ask athletes to estimate distances on grass, they give pretty good estimates, and non-athletes give very different estimates. This is done in VR, and so it wasn't fair. We also did it in real world. They did better there, too. But the basic story is that for very near distances, athletes are just as bad as you and me. But for farther distances, they're much better. So they haven't scaled near space. They just see that the way they see it. But for farther distances, where they've learned things, they get it right. Well, that's the thing, is this is in VR. See, in VR, everything's distorted. So that's, it's a little, yeah. So ignore that. Pay no attention to the man. Yeah, so in the outdoors, for long distances, they were pretty much right on the money. But this distorts everything more than it should. But if you have athletes do the height-distance matching task, if you have them stand away from the pole to be the same distance as the pole is high, they look just like the non-athletes. That is, that knowledge isn't changing their perception of space. They just have a verbal calibration that lets them be more accurate, but it doesn't change how they see things. All right. So the last thing, and that's really it. You guys have been really trippers to sit here and look at data. So what about action? Like, isn't it a little puzzling? Like, if I'm right, and I could be wrong, I think I'm right. We have a lot of data now. But if I'm right, how do we get anywhere in the world? How does this work? Well, think about it. If I want to throw a ball to Ken, I've done it before. I know what's going to happen. I've seen it occur. So I could be totally wrong about where Ken is. And I could be totally wrong about how far this ball is going to travel. As long as I'm wrong in exactly the same way. It's true. Think of your favorite home run slugger, right? He can be totally wrong about where the ball is and where the bat is. As long as they're wrong in the same way every time, he's all set. And that's the key to action, is that when we act in the world, our actions occur in the world that we're seeing. So we don't have to have some magical transform that lets our actions act in the real world while we're seeing a different world. We can act in the world that we see, and as long as that world is distorted in a stable way, as long as it doesn't move around all over the place, we're going to be set. It's a little strange, but it's true. When I throw something, I get feedback about my action from my perception. I don't have some other magic person tell me. I mean, if maybe some sports you do, you know, in golf, you do have to pay attention to how far did that go in yards or whatever. But in most circumstances, when I learn to walk to a chair, I don't have to know how far away that chair is. I have to know how many strides it takes me to get there. And you can, and people like this kind of task people can do. Like you can close your eyes and pick out a spot. You look at a spot, close your eyes, walk to it. You'll be really accurate. Your action system is calibrated to the world you live in perceptually. That doesn't mean the world you live in perceptually is exactly right, but it means it's probably the best one. It's this one that's been expanded to make these differences that are most important to us most available to us. That's my story. Please ask questions, and you can ask about anything.
Evolutionary advantage, right, to overestimating, you know, back in the Neanderthal days.
So I think that the way I think about it, is more simple than evolution. Evolutionary stories are complicated. You have to sort of imagine a counterfactual. And the fact is that some of these experiments, we could do them on animals. That is, you could try to see if animals have similar distortions with the matching tasks. And I haven't tried to get anybody to do that. But the way that I think about it is in terms of information processing. And I tried to say this earlier, basically, but I could put it, I just want to put it in two technical terms, but it's like if you think about having, you know, digital TV with a lot of bandwidth. Digital TV has a lot of pixels and it has a lot of flow, and that's why, you know, we didn't used to have digital TV, we used to have something else. Well, our brains don't have digital TV. Our brains have to send information back through on very slow and kind of not very many cables, and they have to code things really efficiently. And so if you go back to an appreciation of sort of compression algorithms in information processing, what you find is that the best way to code things is to sort of distribute your codes evenly over the likelihood of the occurrence. And if 60-degree hills are never going to occur, don't devote a lot of resources to physical 60. If everything is in the range between 0 and 15, which is pretty much where everything is, make that bigger. Make that bigger. There's never going to be a cost to expanding that. You're going to lose sensitivity other places. And there's other examples that I can go on about where it's the same thing, where we shift our scaling in a perceptual variable to make the part that we care about evident, and we actually lose information about other parts. We give up on information. So we're making choices. But you don't even have to appeal to evolution. It could be happening. I mean, I think it is evolution. I think it's built in, but we have to run those experiments.
I mean, if you were good at judging slant, you could still be bad at judging distance, because in order to get from slant to distance, you have to calculate the cosine of something, and then you could just say the mind is bad at trigonometry. But what you're saying is you're bad, it seems to be you're bad at judging slant, good at calculating the cosine, and therefore bad at judging the distance. Is that right?
No, it has been a puzzle for me as well. That is, your brain could code it wrong, and then just let you see it right. Like, what would be the harm in that? Or it could be, I mean, you're saying in a more complicated way, but, you know, competing. The fact is that I haven't thought this through carefully enough to give you a perfect answer, but this is the right kind of answer, I think. When I walk, I experience the cosine. I see how things change. That is, cosine is about the distance of something relative to the angle. So if my gaze is down here, I'm going to see how that cosine changes. And so I think the cosine stuff is actually given to me to some extent by my actions and by my movements. And that's why the system is so readily able to do these transformative geometries that it seems to be doing. There's a lot of folks out there who have argued that the brain uses a non-Euclidean representation of space. But there, it turns out that a lot of them have been modeling it by creating angular expansions and then doing Euclidean geometry on that. So, yeah, the brain does seem to know a lot about geometry, but it's probably from motion, from the fact that it moves around in the world, which is a very important thing. He was first. I only have one data point about that question, because we don't usually collect height information. There is in the gaze stuff, we haven't observed anything. We haven't looked for sex differences. I don't think we never see sex differences. That is, we always throw sex in, because if you have a analysis in spatial perception, people want to know that there's not a sex difference. Where there's definitely a sex difference is in people's judgments or estimates, verbal estimates of slant of hills. Women tend to give higher estimates than men, and no one's ever explained this. So we did, a few years ago, some of you may have participated, a big alumni survey about the memory for slants of campus paths, and we got a huge sex difference. We included in that survey, for half the people who were in it, a question about their height, so we could see if there was any correlation between height and slant estimates. There was none. The other factor there were like three factors that affected people's judgments. One was whether we had them do a visual measure, like they could adjust a line on the screen versus a verbal measure. So the verbal measures are higher. But the line ones are still very high. Sex made a difference, and knowledge made a difference. If you knew about slants, then you knew to lower your estimate. And that was true for women and men. We don't know why women give higher estimates. But it's not because they're shorter. Yes, yeah, it's like, oh, geez, that's going to be it. Yeah, people have asked that one before, but yeah, I don't actually think that's right. But yeah, no, I understand. I understand why you'd say that. Yeah.
I'm afraid of heights only when I'm faced with a height. There is a metro station in Washington, I think it's the DuPont Circle one. When I get to it, I imagine it to be an absolute straight drop into the center of the universe. The only way I can get down there is holding up both sides and closing my eyes. Sometimes I turn around and hold on to
yeah,
both sides.
Yeah. It's so visceral. Yeah, I mean, it's like the athletes. You know, they can tell me what the right answer is, but it's not going to change how they see it. And I don't know. I don't study fear. There's a little cottage industry of people who do stuff about how does fear affect perception of height, perception of slant. And they always do a terrible job on their experiments. So I don't think I know anything from them. Yeah. So that's the answer is that there's definitely a phenomena there, but I don't think anybody knows the answer, and it's sort of, yeah. So in the study, well, catching a baseball is a different story. So that's all about controlling the velocities on the retina, and you don't have to know anything about distance or height or anything. But we did this study last year with athletes. We wanted to get a bunch of field athletes, and we wanted to get a bunch of basketball players, and we wanted to see if the basketball players would be better at height, and the other folks would be better at distances. And what we discovered is that everybody's an expert at height. And so we didn't, in the matching task, we can't tell what people are, we can't tell one from the other. We don't know what's being exaggerated, what's being underestimated. But we think it's mostly underestimated distance. If you ask people, Swarthmore students, to estimate the height of like that column, and you let them stand, they can look to see where their height matches up, and they count up. And so everybody's an expert because everybody knows how tall they are. So it turned out that people's estimates of the heights of objects that are not too tall, like if you ask them about the water tower, which we've done, that's too many heights. So they can't, they screw that one up. But yeah, everyone's an expert in height, so we couldn't discriminate between the basketball players and the others and the non-athletes. Everybody was right about estimating the heights of the objects we showed them, which were like light poles in the parking lot. So that's an area where everyone has expertise because we all know how tall a person is. Your question about sort of measurement, like potter's clay or something like that, the stuff that I'm looking at with this sort of magnification of space strikes me as it's so universal and so odd. It has nothing to do with anybody's expertise as far as we know. Maybe it does. I mean, but the kinds of things you're talking about feels like it's sort of like imagining transformations. Let's say, what do I know about this? And it's, you have to have some cognitive reference that, okay, that's what 20 pounds looks like, or that's an ounce. That's, you know. So if people learn those correlations, that can then scaffold their perception. They know what to look for. But it's more probably an attentional thing than a perceptual expansion of almost the literal kind that I'm arguing for here. At the back. Not sideways, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't tell you about that. I'm belong to a secret society, Pythagoreans, and no. It's a really good question. Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And I'm joking about the Pythagorean society, but the sine function. You take a sine function from 0 to 90. It basically, as it passes through 0, it's going at an angle, and then it compresses up to 90. Throughout this region, it's got a gain of 1.5. So if we're coding these things in terms of a sine function, which means that we're representing the amount of height over the amount of length of the surface, that would fit, and it would explain the 1.5. I can't understand how that works exactly for the gaze part, but it does fit a sine function pretty well. But we don't understand why. Yeah. So if it was doing that, why? What's the multiplier for? That is, if it's a multiplier, the multiplier drops out of the equation. But this is a simple linear function of grade. Yeah, it's a multiplier. That is the reason I'm sort of rejecting Barry's is because there's a lot of folks out there that have argued that slant perception is based on perceived effort, and they've done a lot of terrible experiments, and we've debunked them. We've been very busy debunking them over and over again. So I'm not very receptive, as you see, to Barry's suggestion, and that's why I'm saying it doesn't even make sense. But numerically it doesn't make sense. For so the yeah. So you're saying the 1.5 is basically the height versus straight distance ratio for effort.
For effort.
For effort, yeah.
Well, you know, biologically wired in based on how many calories it takes
to do various. Yeah, I don't know the data. That I see now what you're saying.
See, that's your sine function, right? I mean, is that the height you have?
Yeah, no, that's right. That would be, that's what we'd have to find out, is whether that would be the answer, as if we could show that there was a 1.5 relationship of caloric expenditure for slope versus flat.
Well, the amount of height you have to go is going to, for a given horizontal distance, is going to go like the sine of that angle. And you're only doing work, you're not doing work to go forward, you're only doing work to go forward.
Yeah, but then I don't understand how it gets more. That is, if I'm trying to compare a 2-degree slope to a 4-degree slope, representing it as 2 and 4, versus 3 and 6 tells me exactly the same information. It's just a multiplier. And I can't compare it to 0. There's no comparison. That's the only. So that's why I'm having trouble with this. Anyway, it's an interesting suggestion.
Knowing that it takes twice as much effort is not necessarily what's relevant. What's relevant is knowing that it takes 10 calories. Right? Because if you preserving a constant ratio, that's losing a information of exactly
Well, would you predict that putting a heavy backpack on somebody would make the hill look steeper?
No, because that assumes that people can make these changes online as they, you know, each experience, as opposed to having this sort of coding.
Would it differ from person to person?
Why are you asking me?
I don't know. Because I hate the effort theory, and they've proposed all of these things, and they've all turned out to be wrong. So, I'm just saying. The more interesting court cases are just about recognition of faces and things like that, where you've seen a guy because he sold you a trick at the train station, but then you misidentify him later because he seems familiar in a lineup. With this stuff, it's just we know that people are going to misdescribe things. So if you know, depending on whether you're expert or not, your sense of what the layout of the space will be or your description of it will be different. But in terms of like actually recognizing a person or something like that, but so or what, you know, what happened or what view did they have? People, you know, we yeah, but people are terrible at judging spatial relationships. I mean, they're good at it in one sense, but they're also bad at it in another. And of course, in an event, when you're an eyewitness, and you're trying to reconstruct it from memory, there's all kinds of problems because you really weren't paying close enough attention to all the things. And, you know, if you walked out of the room and had to name everybody, you know, you just can't do it. You don't store everything about the world. So, yeah, I wish I could answer.
It's clear if you want to hire an expert witness, you need an athlete.
There you go.
For distance,
but not height. Yeah. Then everybody's fine.
So on one hand, you said that if my perception is wrong in the same way that my action is wrong, I'm fine. But on the other hand, the athlete's perception is less wrong.
No, their perception is just as wrong. Their judgment's different. So their judgment is different. Their perception hasn't changed at all, is what I would argue. That's why when they do the matching task, they look just like other folks. When they do a verbal estimation, they know, oh, that's going to be 90 feet or that's going to be 100 yards. So it's only that their ability to convert it to a verbal thing, which, of course, their motor system has no idea what they're talking about. It just knows how to throw the ball the right distance. It doesn't have any idea.
Okay, so the athlete is just converted somehow after repetition?
Yeah, it just knows. It knows, well, that looks kind of similar. Like, that's about a soccer goal kick. So that's 12 yards. So that's been, that's sort of getting back to this question. I mean, I'll tell you a personal story. When I was at Boy Scout camp many years ago, the camp counselor I was with was a rock climber, and he took me he took the kids to climb a rock, and most of the kids could scramble up it, but it was vertical, and I wasn't going to even try. I just did. You cannot climb a vertical surface. It was probably 30 degrees. So certainly, this is the whole thing. It's sort of like your experience of it is going to overwhelm your choices. If you can try to talk yourself out of it. Oh, the snake's fine. It's not going to hurt me. You know, but it's like, that's not going to do anything. So yeah, no, I do think it affects folks differently, depending on how they perceive it. Yeah, we only look at a sort of locomotor space for this kind of research. For slant perception, we've studied small surfaces, not really objects, but you know they're objects, but they're large. But they're small surfaces here, and you get the same kind of sine function representation of slant in near space as you get for large hills. So that function doesn't seem to depend on the size of the surface. It's a real, just the way we see slant is that sine function. The data we have right now shows that for sidewalls, we get the same kind of distortion. And that's different from, like this, I was saying, actually, when you ask people to judge their gaze direction, we don't get the same distortions left and right. And we're not sure if that's because it's easier to sort of tell where 90 is. Oops, 90 is here, whereas up here, people, it's really hard to tell where 90 is up there. It's hard to keep so. But with slant, it's the same. For these kinds of surfaces this way. Yeah. I'm sure there is, but I don't know how hard, like the water tower. It's printed at the base of the water tower how high it is. That was very convenient of them. I can't tell you that. It's to the base, if I'm remembering right, it's 35 meters to the base of the water tower, to the top of the column before it expands out. So that's a height that people can't count off the number of people. Here's what you do. If you see a slope that's 20 degrees, it's probably 5. If you see a slope that's 30 degrees, it's probably 8. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. If you say, oh, it's 20 degrees, it's probably 5. You won't believe it for a little while, but then you get an inclinometer, measure it, you'll see. So, yeah, no, you can. There's totally a transform. Might be different for different people slightly, but, yeah, it's not that hard. Yeah, then my collaborator in Colorado who's supposed to be collecting that data for us, he's been having personal problems. So I don't have the data yet. And why does it work this way? But, so we don't know. We do know that kids' estimates of distance based on their judgments of the sizes of things. So if you have something that's far away and you have to compare it to something here, little kids don't know how to adjust for distance. And the point at which they start to be able to get it just like adults and make that adjustment is the point at which they can say, when things are further away, they look smaller. So they behave very much the way our perception is. So it looks like kids have the same kind of distance distortions we do. Whether that maps into this, the height distance matching, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing it's going to based on that. But great question. All right, thank you guys so much. This was fun.